Good evening and welcome to our healthcare symposium tonight with Professors Richard Epstein and Ted Marmer. I'm Howard Husick. I'm the Vice President for Programs at the Manhattan Institute. And I may have to say all of that again for our recording engineers. Are we okay? All right. Two, three, four. Okay. It's surely an understatement to say that the question of how or whether we reform the U.S. healthcare system is a prominent part of our current presidential campaign and national discussion. It's also an understatement, I think it's fair to say, that this is nothing new. Indeed, in mentioning this evening's event to my 83-year-old father, he reflected on his experience on the debate team in his South Philadelphia Junior High School circa 1938. When the question was resolved, the United States should adopt socialized medicine. I suppose that one could say that in one way or another, that describes our topic of discussion here this evening. And we are fortunate to have two speakers who bring a breadth of knowledge, political, economic, legal, philosophical, to the subject, such that we can gain an understanding both of why healthcare has proved to be such a long-standing and divisive political and indeed politicized issue in this country, and how and whether the contentiousness surrounding it might begin to fade, either through the triumph of one side or another, or the emergence of a consensus. That Richard Epstein and Ted Marmer have different perspectives on the issue is clear from the most cursory reading of their work. If you did a keyword search on Ted Marmer's writing on the subject, you would most regularly turn up the phrase social insurance, while the same from Professor Epstein's work would regularly turn up the phrase cross subsidies and his concern about them. These two themes do not coexist easily, believe me. And we may learn tonight whether they can, and if so, on what basis. I should have mentioned at the outset that our discussion tonight is sponsored by our Center for Medical Progress here at the Manhattan Institute. And I'll now, under their aegis, introduce this evening's speakers. Ted Marmer is Professor, Theodore R. Marmer is Professor Emeritus of Public Policy and Management at Yale School of Management, as well as Professor Emeritus of Political Science and adjunct at the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. He's former director of the Robert Wood Johnson's Foundation's postdoctoral program in health policy and social science. He's a graduate of Harvard University and Wadham College, Oxford. A political scientist, he's authored and co-authored 11 books, including a number on the subject before us tonight, Understanding Healthcare Reform, Why Are Some People Healthy and Others Not, America's Misunderstood Welfare State, and Fads, Fallacies, and Foolishness in Medical Management and Policy. Richard Epstein, a Manhattan Institute visiting scholar this fall, and I'll talk later about additional programs that Richard is going to be involved in for us, is the James Parker Hall Distinguished Service Professor of Law at the University of Chicago, where he's taught since 1972, and the Peter and Kirsten Bedford Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, and currently a visiting faculty member at the NYU Law School. Professor Epstein holds undergraduate degrees from Columbia College and Oxford University, a law degree from Yale, and a doctorate of law from the University of Ghent.
Honorary.
Say again?
Honorary.
Honorary. Didn't say that.
Well, honoris causa, HC.
His work ranges widely across the intersection of law, economics, and public policy and includes takings, private property and the power of eminent domain, forbidden grounds, the case against employment discrimination law, and most recently, overdose, how excessive government regulation stifles pharmaceutical innovation. He has served as a senior fellow of the McLean Center for Clinical Medical Ethics at the University of Chicago Medical School since 1983. Our format will be as follows. Each of our participants, beginning with Professor Marmer, will begin with a 10-minute opening statement, presentation. That will be followed by 5-minute follow-ups by each to the other, what they call it in the League of Women Voter Debates, rebuttals, I guess. Then I will moderate a 20-minute discussion, trying to ask combative questions to each, and then it will be your turn to do the same. So without further ado, Professor Marmer.
Thank you very much. I agreed to come to this session not because I had any illusion about convincing Richard Epstein of anything. Richard Epstein is a persuasive, solidly based advocate of his views, and the chance that I will convert him at this age is vanishingly small. And in our discussions about what to do here, we were both committed to the view that it would be a good thing if we clarified our various positions, and that's what I'm going to try to do in the opening minutes. But I'm going to begin with a story that I hope lightens the atmosphere a little bit, particularly in a group like this. And that is a story about the election of 1960 and the difficulties of communicating to audiences that don't actually hear what you're trying to say. In that election, John F. Kennedy managed to persuade Adlai Stevenson, after the loss in the primary, to go speak on his behalf in Philadelphia. He gave a speech, and at the end of the speech, a woman of mature years came up to him and said, worshipfully, "Governor Stevenson, that was the most wonderful, superfluous speech I've ever heard." And Stevens thought irony was the right response, so he said, "Well, splendid. Given your enthusiasm for the speech, perhaps I should publish it posthumously." To which he responded, she responded, "Wonderful. The sooner the better." So there's a great danger in all talks that you won't understand what the speaker's saying, and the speaker won't understand whether he's communicating or not. So I'm going to do three things in whatever fraction of the 10 minutes Howard keeps track of.
I should do that.
You probably should. First, I want to simply state what I take to be an obviously superior model for financing medical care in the United States. Not the only model, but a superior model, in my view, over the current. Secondly, I want to say why it is I think that what we're now talking about in terms of options is a terribly truncated and unilluminating way of talking about medical care. I'm thinking now about the presidential candidates and their plans. And then thirdly, I want to try to anticipate just a little bit some of the concerns people have about the kind of model that I propose. The first thing to say, and Howard was right about this and wrong about the category socialized medicine, is I'm not an advocate of socialized medicine, but I am an advocate of social insurance, and you could say I'm an advocate of social insurance or socialized insurance. That is to say, there's a big difference between providing medical care and financing medical care, and there's a big distinction between the British National Health Service, which both pays for and provides, and, for example, in Canada or Holland or France or lots of other places, in which there's a collective pooling of the financing, and it's administered and doctored and responded to by patients and physicians and hospitals which are not publicly owned or publicly employed. That's a distinction that is lost on all the people who in a rather sloppy fashion, use the word government medicine, socialized insurance in the same sentence, thinking they're using synonyms. So that's point number one. Point number two is if I had to put up my right hand and sort of take a vow of the five features that of a health financing arrangement in American society that I would favor, I would put my hands up this way. I would say, first of all, whatever financing scheme we come up with, we call it something like social insurance, ought to insure against the expenses of medical care that's ordinarily understood. You might use the word comprehensive, you might use the word ordinary. You don't want an insurance policy in which the gray areas of coverage leave people without certainty about what in fact is insured. And that's true of a lot of our insurance plans now. Secondly, so comprehensive in the sense of ordinary meanings of the word hospital, physicians, pharmaceuticals, and perhaps not long-term care, which is a much different kind of problem. Second, I would want that financing arrangement called here social insurance to cover all of us. I don't know that I would want it to cover people here illegally, although as a matter of practical application, it's very hard to do anything different, but as a legal matter, I don't think I would want to. I would want to say those people who have participated as citizens in the ordinary arrangements of American government, whether by contributing to a special fund, as they do in FICA, or by paying taxes, or just by participating in the workforce, I would have a wide definition of who's covered, because I don't think it's very useful or helpful to make large distinctions among them. The administrative costs of doing so are, in my view, sheer waste. Thirdly, I would be concerned that anybody who had such coverage would have that coverage wherever they lived or moved in the United States, so they wouldn't be engaging in worry about its portability. So comprehensive and universal and portable would be three of the words that I would attach. Now, you'd have to obviously specify much more. And beyond that, beyond the portability, a third point, what I would be concerned about very much, particularly given our present circumstances, that the terms and definition and limits of that coverage would be, on the whole, able to be read by an ordinary graduate of an ordinary high school in the United States. That is, it would not be filled with the complexity and obfuscation that dominates so much of what we do. These are areas that Richard and I agree on. I don't know. But that's an area that any plan ought to address, the kind of confusion and complexity and needless waste that goes along in trying to figure out what it is, in fact, that's covered. But the fifth principle, I would say, and this will be deliberately vague for the moment, is that the payment for that financing should be fair. Now, I recognize at the outset that the definition of what's fair will differ, but I'll make a negative claim, that it ought not to be a flat amount per person or per family. It ought to vary with income, either proportionally or progressively. I'm kind of easy on that. I don't have any special commitment. But there ought to be no connection in my plan between the medical circumstances of the person or family covered and what they pay, a divorce between the pooling of prepayment on the one side and, when you're sick, ill, injured, the payment of medical care by the pooling source, rather than connecting individuals. So I reject, just to be clear, I reject the principle of large-scale deductibles and coinsurance as an allocative device, and I'll be happy to counter whatever argument is presented about that. Coinsurance and deductibles are both administratively complex, economically inefficient as ways of getting people to get the right care at the right time, and they certainly have a distributive effect on who gets what that is to be regretted, at least from my standpoint. Tell me when I'm closing in on 10 minutes, Howard.
About 5 more.
Okay. So I've now just given you the five principles that I would begin with if I were starting to defend it. And if I were to give you an instantiation of it, I would say, actually, if you went from here to Toronto and asked a reasonably informed Toronto citizen what kind of insurance do they have it. That's what they have. Most of the commentary about what goes on in Canada is utterly uninformed. We live in a world in which Canadians receive lots of information going south to north, and there's not very much information that goes north to south. I happen to have spent a good part of my career becoming acquainted with Canada's both virtues and its vices. And, of course, any program of this kind has some characteristic difficulties that go with, but there's no plan whatsoever that doesn't have characteristic difficulties. There's just different ones. So let me shift from the sort of sketch, which you might actually say is a vision that actually Medicare had in the 1960s, but did not actually develop nearly expansively as I would have wished. Let me shift from that to some properties of health financing arrangements of the kind that I suggested with these five features. Number one, if you think about the experience of OECD countries, our fellow industrial democracies, you will discover that the United States has the worst of all possible combinations. We both have spotty coverage and indeed non-coverage for scores of millions and undercoverage for millions more. That is, we both have non-insurance and underinsurance. If you think prepayment for medical care is an important matter, we have big gaps of that sort. On the other hand, we spend more than any other industrial society. Indeed, we spend 50% more per capita than the Canadians do for what they have. If you remember, some people in this room are old enough to know what an old-style Blue Cross Blue Shield plan was in about 1964-5. Service benefits, sometimes, and actually, on the whole, quite modest deductibles and coinsurance. Well, Canada just universalized that. That's what they have. They've got 10 provinces that run their own show. And they pay for it with a combination of all kinds of taxes, both federal income tax and a variety of taxes and premiums at the provincial level. So the commitment to these principles don't tell you exactly the form of financing you do, except to say that you have very little experience rating, which is an important distinction between commercial insurance and social insurance, the connection between the premium paid and the experience of the individual or the group. I'm thinking about, my view is that you should have a chance. My view, but really calling attention to whether or not your prior medical history is relevant or your use is relevant to the premium you pay. But the key thing I want to concentrate on is this, that anybody who is surveying the American medical care scene, I think will be struck with the combination of high expenditure and high dissatisfaction. That doesn't mean all the medical care is bad. In fact, we have wonderful medical care available under lots of circumstances. But in the aggregate, when we spend 16% of our GNP, and we got 46 million underinsured and probably something closer to 80 million underinsured, people feel, and businesses are showing as they shed their employment-related insurance, they're showing that they're dissatisfied with this balance between cost and benefit. But I want to emphasize, just put out for you, and it'll be my last point no matter how much time I've got, because I'll have time after Richard speaks. I want to call your attention to just some comparative statistics, which are true but not determinative of anything. They just simply are associated with my position. One, I've already mentioned to you, the dramatic difference between American costs and the costs of everybody else. Switzerland and Germany are the next two in terms of expenditure. Canada was the second, but it's fallen as their government has tightened the screws in the middle 1990s. So we spend a lot and feel mixed about it, as I was suggesting. And the question is, why is it that we spend so much and these other countries manage to combine universal insurance, that doesn't mean care, with pretty simple and not hard to fathom arrangements with reasonable but not complete satisfaction and a sense that they have done something quite superior. They both spend less and feel better about it. That's a good bargain. Now, that doesn't mean everybody in those countries thinks that, but in every one of those countries, none of their citizen majorities would actually opt for what we do in the United States. And I think it's worth our wondering why that's so. And I call your attention to a remarkable poll that was taken about 6-7 years ago in which Canadians and Americans were asked the following question. Canadians were asked, here's a description of the United States and the mix of programs that we have. Would you prefer to be a person in the United States vis-a-vis medical care under the descriptive circumstances? And the description was given by the Congressional Budget Office, which is a pretty reliable place for accuracy. And the U.S. were given a similar description of Canada. And 2% of Canadians opted for the U.S. 2%. About 1% actually come south of the border every year for care. And 67% of the Americans actually approved of at least the description and the principles, actually, that I just told you about. It's not determinative, but I think it's worth thinking about. If you reject these five principles, you have to ask yourself, why is it that such a large block of Americans and such a substantial proportion of our neighbors to the north regard these principles as attractive enough to vote with their poll, as I suggested? I don't for a moment think you actually decide things by polls, but I think it's worth raising that at the outset, and I'll stop there. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Ted. I should note that I was using socialized medicine in quotes as a synonym for a larger government role, but I take your point.
Yes, and I certainly want to take that point as well. And let me see if I can figure out a way in which I would want to deal with Ted. And this is, I think, the first line of response that I would have in trying to make my own affirmative case. I would think it would be irresponsible for me to come here and to say that the status quo that we have with respect to American medical care today represents the best that we can do or the best that any kind of a market system could do. And so the question that one has to ask is, before we decide to run a system in which there's at least a state monopoly with the provision of capital and all the risks that monopoly power will entail, is there something we could do to move very sharply in the opposite direction and try to unravel the peculiar and indefensible mix of subsidies on the one hand and penalties on the other hand, which characterize the modern American political system? That is, there is no question that, if you wish, as a short-term political explanation as to how it is we got into this position, I would say that it's largely attributable to the New Deal judgment that on matters of economics, there are no such things as definite property rights, and the Congress can either tax or benefit any group in any particular way for whatever reason it wants. And when you have a system which is that loose, what you will do is you will find not only social insurance, you'll find barriers to entries, all sorts of cross-subsidies, most of which are essentially indefensible. The difficulty with this particular way of working the world is as follows. The people who say, well, you've put this particular subsidy in place, now you've got to add this tax, and somehow or other they'll cancel each other out. It never does. My own view about every single form of state regulation that deviates from competitive market principles is they essentially compound felonies and lead us to a position which is exactly the one which we have today, where we spend more and get more, but not as much more as we should get relative to what we've had. And since interest groups are always trying to protect themselves and to exclude others, it's not at all clear, or not at all surprising, rather, that we should have such spotty and inconsistent coverage. Before I try to explain what I think is wrong with Ted's sort of somewhat Pollyannish view of the way in which cross-subsidies would work in the modern age, let me just sort of mention a couple of the things I think that really matter with respect to our system. And in some of these cases, it's suggestive to note that there really are major differences between us and the Canadians, which point heavily in the Canadian direction, because they're actually more market-oriented than we are. Let me start with one such illustration, which is the role of medical malpractice with respect to modern situations. And there is no question in the United States that any voluntary arrangement to transport medical disputes out of the court system into a private system of arbitration governed by contract rules gets you punitive damages if you try to propose it. So heavily are we committed to this particular situation. We know, roughly speaking, and I'll actually use the statistics, that the level of medical malocurrences that one could identify with Canadian care is about the same as it is in the United States. The difference is that we spend 10 times more with respect to our malpractice system than they spend with respect to theirs. That, of course, is an understatement of the actual differences, because when you're trying to figure out the cost of regulation, the one thing you must never do is to assume that the only costs that matter are those which appear on somebody's ledger. You also have to ask the question of what kinds of incentives are induced with respect to the kind and sorts of care that are given. And in fact, if defensive medicine seems to be as important as many people suggest that it is, oh, what will happen in the United States is that there will be all sorts of expenditures that blend themselves back into basic medical care, which are attributable to the liability system, even though there is no particular way that we can start to identify them with it. So one of the things that one would want to do is, if anything, to adopt the Canadian medical malpractice system root and branch and to trim things down, or in my view, actually go much more market-oriented with respect to this situation. And what will happen? The first approximation is that the cost of running the healthcare system will be reduced. Where will it be reduced the most? Ironically, it will be in small rural clinics which pay high premiums, even though they have a low volume of patients, because pricing by experience rating is very difficult. When you lower the price, what happens is that the access to care starts to increase without centralized control, without new taxes, without various kinds of cross-subsidies. And so that's the strategy that one wants to follow for this and for every other program. A second kind of situation, which I think is more acute here than in Canada, though I don't want to speak to the Canadian situation, and that's, for example, the issue with respect to medical licensing. I have no doubt that the inability of people from one state to move quickly and effectively to practice medicine in another state creates all sorts of artificial shortages and drives up the price of medical care beyond what it ought to be. I've known people, for example, my friend Regina Casper, when she went out to California with my former dean, Gerhard Casper, to practice medicine there, they didn't let her practice for 2 years because she could not produce the records from her undergraduate education in 1955, mainly because the entire building which housed them had burned down. And so what you do is you see all sorts of situations like that. And what happens is you then create imbalances in the provision of care. The licensing system turns into a monopoly system. The monopoly system reduces access and raises cost. And again, you have the kind of problem you have in the United States. Here's a third illustration, which I think, in effect, has similar kinds of problems, because there's another problem to be explained, which is if you look at the percentage of people in the United States who've become uninsured, that percentage, as not only the absolute terms, seems to be increasing. And it also seems to be increasing at the time that national incomes are increasing. And there's no particular Canadian analogy to this. What you always have to figure out is why is it that as wealth increases, coverage goes down? And again, it seems to me that the argument in this particular case has a great deal to do with the systems of regulation that have been put into place in the United States. One of the things that Americans who favor comprehensive health care do, which the Canadians, strangely enough, do not, is they impose all sorts of rather expensive mandates on employers for the kind of insurance that they could provide. A mandate that demands that you pay something which costs you more than an employer value it is an implicit tax. The moment you start putting taxes on voluntary relationships, what happens is they start to disintegrate if the total subjective gain to the two parties from the transaction is less than the tax that is imposed. Ben Zeiker of the Manhattan Institute constantly preaches two words, and I'm going to repeat them right now, and they're ones that you ought never to forget. The words are called excess burden. And what that means is every time you impose a tax, whether explicit or implicit, on any given voluntary transactions, you not only shift wealth to the government from private parties, but you reduce the number of voluntary transactions that start to take place. And so hence you now have a perfectly sensible positive account as to why this happens. What kinds of insurance are going to work with this? Well, we know. Very expensive neonatal care, very expensive end-of-life care, all sorts of coverage for psychiatric care and for mental stuff. Interestingly enough, when Ted talks about universal health care in Canada, he says that everybody gets the same package, but ironically in America, those who do get packages usually get them richer than they want by virtue of the mandates in question. And so again, if you started to deregulate, my guess is you would move in market equilibrium to lower prices and higher degrees of access so that our system of regulation would look a little bit more like the Canadian system, but again, avoid all the difficulties associated with cross-subsidies and similar kinds of situations. Let me give you another illustration of the same problem in a different area. 3 minutes. Community rating is a classic illustration in which what you do is you charge people the same rate regardless of risk in a world in which they could opt out. And sure enough, what happens is they don't want to pay cost subsidies, so that a large fraction of the 47 million people in the United States who are uninsured are in fact people who are relatively in the peak of health care who do not wish to have the various kinds of protections that are involved. The other thing I think which that you should mention with respect to what's going on in this system is that the subsidies that we give to some groups of individuals lead to systematic overconsumption of medical care. If you're looking at Medicare or Medicaid, it is impossible to know which of the particular expenditures are the ones that are overconsumption relative to everybody else. But what we do know is you draw more and more people into that system, then you're going to have to regulate access and regulate fees. The subsidy of Medicare is what drives the really complicated compliance costs. And in addition, as it draws people into guaranteed markets, it puts a tax on the supply of physicians so that the unregulated markets, which are often the benchmark for the payments in the regulated market, they get transformed in the same way, and all of a sudden that you get increase in costs going on both sides. It is, I think, a sign of the future that if you try to generalize Medicare, you're in a system now where the actual recipients pay through primary premiums of one form or another basically about 25% of the total cost that they pay altogether. The rest of it comes from general taxes, and make no mistake about it. General taxes, like specialized implicit taxes, create excess burdens, and these create a drain in the economy. In fact, one of the ways to understand Canada is to realize that its rather poor economic performance relative to the United States in areas unrelated to medical care are not just simply a coincidence. It's a highly regulated country and a highly taxed country, and when you put those things together, what you do is you see a general decline in the standard of living at the same time that there's an increase in the way in which you have health care. And the last point that I want to make about this is that any time one wants to talk about markets is against government, the following point has always to be observed. When you're dealing with government-type situation, you will use the familiar situation of trying to get one size to fit all. The kinds of bundles that you provide, the coverages that you offer to different people are going to be relatively static. In a market system, it turns out when you have heterogeneity in the population, which we do in the United States in abundance, we have it by ethnicity, we have it by age, we have it by conditions of one kind or another, by occupation, the price that you pay in terms of running a somewhat more expensive administrative system has an offsetting benefit, which is to provide coverage which is more tailored to the needs of the individuals that are involved. And if you could get it to market institutions, it's much more stable as a political system, because if everybody's involved in a win-win transformation, then you don't have this constant effort to subterfuge a system or to reduce its coverage because you happen to be a net payer who is getting very little out of the system. So the public choice dynamics of a single payer system are very much more difficult. So which system, summing up, how ought we to try to think about this problem? And I think that the fundamental difference between Ted and myself is this. Before I want to get myself involved in any expansive, imaginative single-payer plan, which has failed everywhere else it's been tried in terms of sort of government monopolies over railroads or whatever else it is, start with a little bit of consistent deregulation. And if you could get new entry into these businesses, and this is the key point, by allowing Walgreens or whatever it is to practice medicine, you would so transform the cost situations that the Americans' experience would then become the envy of the world instead of what it is today in many senses, which is a most regrettable illustration of everything that can go wrong in a mixed economy. Thank you.
Ted, 5 minutes.
Well, I knew when I accepted that the pace that Richard speaks would represent an excess demand of words.
Excess burden?
An excess burden on the debater. I actually asked for additional time.
On the grounds that
Richard's production of words, which don't have even paragraph stops, constitute a form of illegal conduct under any fair suit. I'm just going to take 3 points and we'll see how far that goes. First, Richard doesn't know very much about medical care. It's really true. For example, the last point about 25%, Richard, you're just pulling that out of the air. You have no idea. You don't study medical economics. That's not your field. I don't mind that it's not your field, but you should not act as if you're informing people about these facts. Second, the embrace, what you were talking about is a part associated with Part B payments, but that's only Part B payments. You actually have to know the Medicare's Part A, B, C, and D. And you float high enough across the ground that you don't get into contact with those matters. That's point number one, and that's a serious point, because I think where we're best off is you're holding out for a market, this is my second point, for a market conception of the proper allocation of medical care. That's what you really believe. You fundamentally are oriented to thinking that there's no difference between medical care as a service or a good than any other consumer good. And you think it ought to be allocated like the rest of the market economy. I disagree, and so do most people in the world, in our industrial divide. That's not a good argument against your believing it, but it is important that you not be cavalier about the description, for example, of Canada. If you look at the Canadian growth rates over the last decade, it doesn't support your proposition. Moreover, in the Canadian context, fair enough, it's important to say, they do have a single-payer plan in every province, in everyone, and you concede in Mortal Peril, your book, that that's a powerful countervailing anti-inflationary force. It is, and it works that way, and it's important actually for people to understand. You might say that a powerful countervailing single-payer plan is too strong and reduces people's options in ways that are important. That's a fair consideration that's worth considering, but we ought to be, I think, comparing plausible options with plausible options, and what you can say is the evidence is in that when you've got a relatively generous insurance plan in which doctors, hospitals, and patients all combine to increase demand on the system, because more is better for all of them, in fact. Under those circumstances, you need powerful countervailing forces to stop it from getting out of hand. Third-party payments plus doctors plus patients is to inflation as gasoline is to matches. And so in the Canadian context, guess who are the people who actually restrain expenditures? It's not the health department. It's not doctors. It's not hospitals. It's actually the other organized constituencies in each province who will lose if expenditures to medical care rise more rapidly than income. The powerful forces are organized at the cabinet level. I don't care if one likes it. It's just an empirical fact that, in fact, it constrains. Now, we could talk about the distributive fairness of the results on who gets what, but I think it's really important to pose the comparison this way. The vision of a deregulated open market in medical care does not describe any reality you can turn to now. So it's a projection of a set of principles on the world. You're comparing that world with the world we've got now, which it looks unfavorable, as Richard says, or you can compare it to the world that I was describing, which has empirical reference and has been demonstrated to be the case. I leave you with this objection. If what's optimal is not doable, it's not optimal. Or another way of putting it, the expected value of a proposal is that proposal perfectly done times the probability that it will be done. And I want to offer to you the argument that Richard's expansionist aspiration for a world we haven't seen has to be discounted sharply by the absence of evidence in medical care. And the reason I say that, and that's really what I want to emphasize, is where we differ is that I regard medical care as a merit good, and he regards it as a market good. I think the distributive principles for allocating who gets what in medical care should not reflect the size of your wallet, but should reflect the size of your burden, medically and injury. That's a fundamental, and I don't think there's anything wrong with people who believe in an alternative principle saying we start at different points and we end at different points because they're so fundamental. But I do think it's important that one criticizes projections of a future based on a model that's in someone's head and has not been demonstrated in the world of medical care to be either acceptable to populations or, in fact, capable of generating the economic constraints that I was talking about in the Canadian case.
All right.
Richard, yeah, 5 minutes.
5 minutes, yeah. I have a lot of things to disagree with, Ted. First of all, let me just start with the last point about markets and merit goods. Notice those were not phrases that I used.
I didn't accuse you.
But let me sort of finish. What I meant by the statement is that if you look at the American system, there has been a progressive increase in forms of regulation that were not done 25 and 30 years ago, and that if you could simply reverse those, that would change the level of access and the price, and therefore reduce the number of insureds without creating some of the political risks that are associated with our activities. That is a very different proposition from one which says that in a world either then or now, all medical health care is only going to be distributed under an ability to pay. If you go back to the period of laissez-faire at its peak between 1870 and 1900, and I do know something about this, it was the period of the rise of the charitable hospital. There were all sorts of other kinds of mechanisms that were used to try to take care of people. Ted is absolutely right. There has never been a society, nor is there one that I've advocated, which doesn't believes that there's a perfect correspondence between the utility of medical care and the level of wealth that you have to provide it. And when he referred to mortal peril, he did not refer to the passages which I said, in effect, that wealth is quite a bad proxy with respect to health care and utility, and that we have to think of these other mechanisms. But it's not a state secret that this is the case, and so long as private individuals and voluntary organizations of this sort are there, it seems to me that you cannot simply say that a case for deregulation is necessarily a case for hard-heartedness, nor can you say, since you're trying to return and undo things that are specific, that these things are unattainable, because some of them, and many of them in particular, are already used in Canada. Let me just give you another sort of feature about the American system which creates immense difficulties, which is when it starts coming to trying to do third-party payers. one of the things that you have to understand is third-party payers that insist on contractual provisions with respect to their own voluntary agreements are often found that they will be discredited, and if they seek to enforce them, they'll be exposed to very heavy punitive sanctions. So what you have in this system is a disregard of market principles, which means that natural monitors cannot perform the kinds of functions. There's absolutely nothing in what Ted says that is true insofar as it indicates that inherently only governments can figure out how to impose restrictions by having this model of conflicting interest groups divide up a pie. But if you have a world in which private parties are supposed to discharge that function and then are going to be sued in every which form and way when they seek to do it, what you do is you have yourself a recipe for failure. The last point I want to make is, again, there's a transplant problem. Trying to bring a Canadian system into the United States is going to be proved quite nightmarish in a whole variety of ways. You're talking about a difference in population of maybe 30 million as opposed to 300 million. You're talking about a vast heterogeneity of population in the United States, which is probably not there in Canada. You're going to have to superimpose this on various kinds of institutions that are already in place, like Medicare. And it's worth remembering in 1993, when the Hillary Care went down in flames, it was opposed most strongly by the AARP, because they understood that if you tried to generalize the level of care that's provided, and Medicare Part B does give you a 75% subsidy, it's a non-trivial element of the whole system. Medicare Part D, I don't know what it does, although it's worked better than many people have thought that it would. But if you have that, there is going to be a very strong resistance to the program that Ted is talking about. And so what you have to do is to take his own rhetoric and work it against him. What makes you think that when you start to put this system before Congress with all the powerful interest groups that are at play, from the trial lawyers on down, that you will emerge with anything that remotely looks like the five principles that you're talking about? I think it's a respectable argument to say that that might be better than the system that we currently have if we could attain it. But I also think it's unattainable. And how do I know that? If you look at the recent Hillary Care proposal, she does not start this way. Right. She says, you know, I think that I'm going to leave you guys who have the coverage that you like with the coverage you have. And why does she do it? Because one of the things that Ted did not mention is that it's not clear that you can buy more in Canada than they will provide you, even if you're willing to pay for it, which is why some people come down there. That's what shot down, one of the other things that shot down Clinton Care back in 1993. Rich people wanted to spend more of their disposable income on this kind of stuff, and now we have somebody who thinks that it's politically sustainable that you're going to be able to tell them, you can spend all that you want on lollipops and toy trains, but if you've got a permanent case of cancer, well, you're going to get on the queue along with everybody else. And frankly, we won't go to Cuba to get our medical care, but what will happen is there'll be a mass migration out, and the moment there is, there will be powerful political resistance inside this country against the program that has there. So Pollyanna comes in every which way, and all I was arguing for was a modest dollop of deregulation to reduce the access program, the access problem before you considered various kinds of cross-subsidies. And the question I would leave Ted with is, he actually against any of the things that I am for? And if he is, I'd like to know why. And then I would want to ask the question as to whether or not they're incompatible with any of the five principles that were put forward.
Well, we could keep going, but I think we're going to try to...
I assure you we could keep going.
Yeah. I think we can keep going with rebuttal and counter-rebuttal. Yeah.
But let me just say one thing. I will respond to Richard's last point, and I will agree with him more than he thinks.
Well, I didn't think you would.
Indeed, I think one could argue that we've attained a surprising negative consensus that reform is desirable, and of neither kind is it attainable.
Well, it's difficult. Attainable is another matter. But his point about my not answering is that I didn't disagree all that much with his modest efforts.
Well, that makes you a
let me try to start off my promised combative questions with the following. Richard, Ted has accused you of dreaming of an ideal world and not being able to spell out the details of a practical world. Right. To a certain extent, he has also written that you're conflating health care with consumer goods generally, and in fact, no different than fast cars, is I think a phrase that he used. And that you repeated in your negative review of his book.
Which I never read.
Shocking.
Right. I wonder you mentioned that if we had a more market-based system, that there would be some people who would, in effect, be left out. And the only thought you offered about that was a reference to charitable hospitals in the 19th century. I wonder if you can address the likely outcome when individuals who could not afford certain insurance schemes that would cover their conditions, but they suffered from curable conditions that they could not afford to obtain, how that would be treated by the body politic and whether a system that is more market-based would, in those situations, be sustainable.
Well, let me just first refer to EMTALA, which is the Emergency Medical and Active Labor Act, Treatment and Active Labor Act. And this was essentially a Reagan initiative, which was designed to make sure when you knock on a hospital door and you're in active labor, a serious condition, they have to take you in. And everybody but me was in favor of this statute. And the question is, once you do this, how many emergency rooms are you going to have? And they closed down at a fairly high level. I was involved at the University of Chicago because, you know, contrary to Ted, I've been doing healthcare work for 30 years too, in which we've had solemn deliberations on why it is that we would not open up our emergency room again after the city had nixed our bypass agreement that we made with other folks. I mean, just a classic illustration of you could get into an emergency room that isn't there. All right, the second point I want to make is actually, I want to be very blunt about this, and I think it's appropriate. I think there is nothing more delusive than the principle of universal anything, whether it has to be with universal health care or no child left behind. And that's because it ignores one of the fundamental truths about all social organization, which is the marginalist principle. If you want to figure out, for example, trouble in organizations, the usual rule of thumb in a school or in a work is that 95% of the trouble comes from 5% of the people who are inside the business. When you apply that to insurance, you try to get yourself up to that last 5% of the people, you are on such a steep point with respect to the healthcare curve that if you are in effect are willing to take every chronic diabetic into the hospital 10, 20, 30 times, no matter how much they disregard their meds and so forth, it's not going to work. The implicit rationing system under a charitable care system was always, we'll do it once, we may do it twice, even three times, but sooner or later we're going to let you die. Well, why are we going to let you die? Because we think it's an affirmative good? No. But because we think the resources that we're going to use to keep your life going for an extra 2 or 3 weeks are in effect far greater and better, are so enormous that they're better used to keep 20 people alive whom we could fix once and fix them correctly. And what happens with these aspirations that you have of sort of getting everybody in under the tent is that what you do is you create this crazy dynamic where the squeakiest wheel gets the largest amount of attention. And one of the reasons why it is that EMTALA has created this rather systematic effect is that it allows the squeakiest wheel, the noisiest person, the most expensive party, to cake the situation. And I think that in this and in education and every other area of public stuff, what we have to do is to understand that you'll never get to 100%. You're kidding yourself if you think you're going to try. If you aim for 95%, you may be able to do that. What I'm suggesting, in effect, is you could get a long way there by the sort of modest reforms that I've talked about. They're not so modest. Everyone would be fiercely fought by somebody, believe me. And then what you do is you have a smaller redistribution problem to pay. So I want to handle the cost side first, and I think the terrible mistake in this current debate over national health care, at least in the political arena, is they treat the provision of health care and the various mechanisms now in place as simply outside discussion, and the only thing they're trying to figure out is whether we have Ted's plan or Hillary's plan or Barack's plan. Nobody seems to be in favor of my plan, but I think it's a very different kind of a world than the one I'm talking about.
Ted, you alluded to the good care that many Americans get and the high quality aspects of many aspects of our health care system, even though you focused on the gaps, I guess one would say.
Right.
One of the by reputation, I think clearly, one of the aspects of the American system, which is the envy of the world, is our innovation, both in healthcare devices and in the development of pharmaceutical drugs, which are then used by the Canadian system and the Europeans. It can be argued that in a system in which the government is, as you, to use your phrase, working actively to restrain expenditures, right, that the profits which fuel this innovation are going to be capped, and as a result, that innovation is going to slow to a standstill.
But standstill doesn't follow from slow. That's a leap in your question, but it's a fair point. It's a fair question. I think anybody who advances the arguments that I've advanced has to ask, where will the drive for innovation in either drugs or devices come from if the profit-seeking and profit-making impulse is restrained? And I concede that. I think it's important for you to know that although we do fund an enormous amount of the pharmaceutical research and a good deal of the device research, an awful lot of the inventions of the post-Second World War medical world were actually developed in England and not in the United States. And there it was not developed because it was developed in any kind of profit-making company, but because in the medical research world of universities and medical research councils, there's another motive, which is honor and fame, which actually drives. We think of that in terms of Nobel laureates rather than drug manufacture. But I think it's a fair point, and I think the NIH, we're a scheme like Canada's imposed on the United States, or actually thinking about Canada, they need to sponsor both universities and research institutes to a much higher degree to provide the fiscal wherewithal, which is now skimmed or drawn from substantial profit margins. So I don't disagree with that point at all. Now, there is if I wanted to be the kind of democratic, you know, hellraiser, I would now start talking about the Me Too drugs and the amount of marketing. I think it's a mindless and endless. It's true. I'm now an expert witness in cases where it's absolutely certain that a number of the pharmaceutical industries lied through their teeth in trying to get reimbursement from Medicare and Medicaid and behaved very badly. But what do we get if we focus on that? Your question is not about their conduct, their ethical conduct in various forms of dispute with the American government, but rather who bears the risk of the experimentation that takes place in devices and drugs. And it follows that those who advance my plan better have some alternative sources of support for research, or they're going to have be a slowdown, even if a good deal of the research now is in Me Too drugs. So that's the response I give you.
Richard, I wonder if I can try again. You're so, shall I say, worked up about the problems of our present system, mm-hmm. right? That I'd like to press you again to spell out in a little bit more detail what the Epstein system would look like, how consumers, citizens would experience. I think, to be fair, Ted has done that. He said it will look just like what people in Toronto see today. Mm-hmm. Would we have basically the same insurance plans across the country, large insurance companies that are offering great graded plans? Some people would have very high deductibles. Some people would have only catastrophic insurance. What would the Epstein world look like?
See, I think you have fallen into a serious trap by putting this particular question. The argument that he's trying to make is act as though you favor markets, which are decentralized institutions that innovate in ways that you don't understand, and then knowing nothing about how it is that they're going to operate, tell us what exactly they're going to do. The whole point of this particular system is exactly the opposite. I am not sure, at least as an academic, as to what the optimal form of a market should be with respect to medical malpractice.
Didn't say optimal.
Even the variations. I could give you three or four combinations that would be plausible.
Good.
But you know, the answer is which of them turns out to win would be a competitive enterprise. So some guys are going to push arbitration under the current system. Other people are going to demand customary standards. Some are going to put caps on damages. Some people will insist upon no lawyers and representations. Others will demand sort of mediation that takes place before litigation can start. There are a dozen possible alternatives that are out there. The whole point of favoring a market system is that it's not going to be one guy in his skull telling everybody else how to do something, which is the TED view. I mean, to some extent, this is the way it's going to be. It's a question of having lots of people work out there and then by imitation, experimentation, figure out which of these things are going to succeed and which of them are not. And I have some predictions because we do know that certain deregulated markets have moved very sharply away from the paradigmatic situations. For example, as a contract scholar, one of the things that you discover is that almost – invariably. In voluntary markets, the limitation on consequential damages for adverse consequences is extremely steep in virtually any kind of contract that you would want. It is interesting when you have the same distribution of low probability, high severity risks in certain kinds of businesses, there are caps on damages that are upheld with some difficulty in the courts and universally insisted upon by the parties. I'm quite confident that that pattern would carry over, and if so, it's a striking departure from the current model. And who's that model created by? It's created by a bunch of judges who have no sense of how markets operate, don't understand the sort of the law and economics of the whole system of incentives and cooperative behavior, and they kind of use 1960 economics and sort of New Deal progressivism to say ex post compensation is the only objective of the system. And the whole point about markets is that's not what they're after. What they're after is ex-ante maximization of consumer and producer surplus, which is a completely different measure. And so if you get the right measure, you'll start to move in ways that do that, and that would be the kind of prediction that I would start to make.
I'm going to ask one more question of Ted and then throw it to the audience just because I wanted to make it two and two and make it fair. Ted, you said administrative costs are sheer waste in the private system, sheer waste. You use the phrase.
Yes.
Right? At the same time, the New York Times, not known as a conservative newspaper, last year had a multi-part series on the extensive fraud in Medicare reimbursements. Right? Doesn't the private system protect against exactly that kind of a situation?
The answer is no. Would you like me to elaborate? That is, you don't have a bit of evidence to support the view that the private health insurance industry is better at protecting against this
fraud. If they have to pay the claims, why wouldn't they scrutinize them?
For the same reason that there's a complex arrangement here. Two things are really important. There is fraud and abuse in medical care, both in the private system and in the Medicare and Medicaid system. I'm very familiar with it. It's actually bigger than I would have expected it to be, and a lot of it actually has to do with the absence of serious monitoring on both the private insurance side and the public insurance side. Now, why it is the case that we are doing it on the side, and there's a good point buried in that issue. I was thinking about the scale of our administrative apparatus, much of it involved in competitive marketing of different plans. Mm-hmm. I think we probably underinvest in the monitoring, because with a $2 trillion medical economy, there's the amount of money floating around is just massive, and we now have in both the DOJ and the Inspector Generals a good deal of evidence about the degree of fraud, and it is sad but true that when you're dealing with sums of that kind, very small takes on a scale of numbers turns out to be very big numbers. So I do not want to associate myself with the belief that a zero administrative cost picture would be a good one. And it's very hard to be clear exactly about the administrative costs of American medicine. But what is clear, even though there's some people in the Manhattan Institute who think differently, is that our competitive arrangement for insurance is very costly to administer in three ways: in marketing expenses, in the degree of oversight and regulation of both physicians and patients as to what they can do, and in the degree of dispute about what it is they decide to do. Medicare spends something like 3% of its outlays on this. I think that probably understates what they should pay, but it's vastly different than the private sector, which has costs of a kind not required if you coerce people to pay into the pool, which is what I'm for.
We have time for your questions. Yes, sir.
Can I have a little bit of water?
Absolutely.
This is for either of you.
Well, that was both of us.
or both. It seems to me that based on various readings and information that there seems to be a possibility that if you combined a medical savings account kind of thing where you could keep it, not the use it or lose it kind, and build up and had guaranteed and maybe even government-funded catastrophic insurance at about the level of 10,000 or whatever the appropriate level was, and a reform like the English fee system for medical malpractice cases.
That
combination, it seems, I don't see how that could fail to be better than what we have.
Oh, I can answer part of it. you cannot use the English fee system and the American jury system together. What happens is once juries know that fees will follow outcomes, it will pollute the outcomes in the underlying cases. The English have the fee system. They don't have the anything like our American contingent fee system. They don't have the size of the verdicts and so forth. This is a classic illustration where if you try to run the transplantation through, are you controlling one variable, but you're not controlling the other three? That's why the contract solution, which gets you into arbitration and changes the dynamics of the thing, could control all dimensions of the problem at once.
But the real cost is not the large verdicts, but the constant... the smaller cost of defense settlements that don't go to jury.
I think it's really complicated to say that. And many of the costs are neither of the above. It turns out it's the threat of suit and the kinds of primary behaviors that it induces, which is the real difficulty. But let me just again say, if you could privatize the litigation the way in which most businesses do, you will probably minimize the distortions that are created by the tax on the basic situation and the administrative cost on the back. And those systems, interestingly enough, deviate very systematically in terms of the formality and the rules on discovery and everything else from those that you have. And commercial arbitration amongst major businesses, international and national, completely without legal enforcement in some cases, is a very rapid growing segment of the company, of the world, and it bears no relationship to anything we have in the civil system today.
Richard addressed the legal side of that. I wonder if you would pick up on the first part, which was health savings accounts.
Right. Health savings account is a conception of financing which says what we do in the financing model here is protect you from financial disaster. We're not interested in what effect it has on most use of medical care. It is flood insurance of a certain kind. And if people can advocate that and argue that what at the very least you want is flood insurance. But what I'm saying is that's proposition number one. And if I couldn't do what I want to do, that's the next thing I would do. But I want to distinguish protecting against financial floods from actually making it more fair about who gets what access to what. That's the merit good point. It doesn't address that. It addresses the protection against financial disaster. And I agree with Richard here that the world we have in medical malpractice is just horrible. It both is expensive to individual doctors, and in the aggregate, those medical malpractice premia are trivial in connection with our costs, yet doctors believe they're an important element. Everything's in the defensive medicine response.
Exactly.
And we have a lot to learn. I agree, however, also with Richard, that when you think of transplanting an institutional practice from somewhere else, you better make sure that you've got the relevant ingredients of that institutional practice and not just one of them. And here I agree with him that the Canadian arrangements are far superior. Canadian doctors do not live in fear of malpractice suits. They've got various devices which push to arbitration like arrangements, and people are not rewarded disproportionately for taking risks with cases that have high upside, which is what functions in part in our contingent fee arrangement. It shows up also in the asbestos litigation that I deal. This is my concession to one of the elements that Richard, I believe if I'm going to be critical, I should be candid also about where I agree.
Appreciate it. Gentleman over here.
First of all, I disagree with you about it's only financing. The whole purpose of the medical savings account.
Wait, hold on, the microphone is not working.
Was to bring in the patient in the economics of his own care.
Well, that
was the purpose of it. It's a financing arrangement.
And that's why I said it's a protection against flood, and because you're bringing it in the financing individually, if you know something about the literature, you will know that with high deductibles, there's no question that it distributes medical care in connection with ability and willingness to pay, which was the first principle I said I rejected.
Well, you started with fair, and I don't believe the world is fair.
That may be true, but get me. I'm answering this question by making it clear something that I think is quite clear to the person who asked the question.
I'd like to start with a statement that was made by John Stossel. The problem that we have, your solution is insurance. You call it social insurance. John Stossel says that our problem is not the issue of 47 million uninsured. Our real problem is 253 million people who are in fact insured. The biggest single problem we have is our model. Our model is broken. What we have is an employer paying our premiums, a government or an insurance company, a very deep pocket paying it, and a patient going in for service having no economic interest in what happens. So naturally you have no competition, which is something that Professor Epstein
You have no competition with between hospitals?
You really have no competition because you go in and you never ask your doctor what it's going to cost. If you find out in certain areas, like cosmetic surgery as an example, the cost of medical care and cosmetic surgery has not gone up. Yes, it's gone down, in fact. Why? Because people ask what it's going to cost them to go in for such surgery. We do not have that in what we have. The model has to change, and one of the principal problems that we have is most people in America, and I agree with you, if you ask them, they'll take 67%, which is the number you use, would pick the Canadian system because they don't know another system, because the only system that they've known since they've grown up was since World War II, which created the artificial system we have.
Well, let me just say, put it this way. I think you've stated a critique of the current arrangements that actually Richard and I would agree with. So we have no disagreement with you. If you've got a third-party payment scheme, in which someone receives, another gets, and a third pays, I think that's a recipe for inflation. I think I said that. And what I said, which you didn't pick up, your remedy is different from mine, but your diagnosis is identical to mine. And what's interesting is you didn't see that.
Yeah, can I make a comment?
Please.
I think on this thing, the other feature of the Canadian system that I mentioned before, which I think is extremely important, is that when you're trying to figure out the cost of medical care, it's not just simply the percentage of the budget that's devoted any more than it is for malpractice. There is the problem of queuing, and one doesn't know exactly how serious it is, but it seems that the jokes in Canada have this Soviet style associated with them. Whenever you see bad humor, it suggests that there's serious problems, so that the common line is, it's much easier to get your cat an MRI than it is to get yourself an MRI. It's also clear, and again, Manhattan Institutes have done these studies, but they've been replicated elsewhere, is if you do get sick in the United States with cancer and you get our grade A care, you'll do much better than you'll do in the Canadian system with their so-called grade A care. And part of it goes back to the drug problem. The Canadians, of course, are classic free riders. They're monopsony buyers. The United States does the innovation. We tend to pay the high price. They pay marginal cost. If you could switch those costs around, it would change things. But in fact, we get the better of the bargain, notwithstanding the fact that they freeload. Because what we do is we get many more of the first generation drugs. And so if you actually run comparative statics on asking if you get type 2 colorectal cancer, what's the probability of survival in Canada, the United States, Great Britain, in Japan, we come out clearly number one. One of the problems that the Canadians have is they universalize their care, but it's not clear that the universal care that they get is better than that which most Americans have under voluntary plans. And so there's don't say come on.
You have no basis for that.
I'm just giving you some studies with respect to cancer survival, and I think that's a relevant thing that one wants to look at.
That's relevant. That's one thing.
All right, well, that's what I said.
Your command.
No, don't tell me my command.
About Canada and the United States, you've not mentioned any one of 10 that would be counter-arguments. You've selected. I think it's true about colorectal. That's true.
Okay.
So what?
You picked up one.
Tell me what the results are in life expectancy at age 65.
Well, look, I mean,
Tell me what you know about any of those things.
I know a lot about that, Ted.
Answer it, Ted.
I will, damn it. God, you just are so abusive.
Getting a word in edgewise with you.
No, Ted, you don't say that. The American life expectancy since 19, at age 65, has advanced only about 3 to 4, maybe 5 years since 1950. What is so striking about it is it shows no correlation with the expenditures associated with Medicare. If you're looking at life expectancy, it was 46 at birth in 1900, 54 in 1920, 61, or rather 59 in 1930, 61 in 1940, 65 in 1950. The differences are quite extraordinary, and it proves the basic point. The huge increase in the Medicare expenditures in the United States has paid off relatively little in this particular regard. Yes, I do know the statistics.
All right. We're going to get a couple audience questions because we're going to – yes, gentlemen, Harry.
I think the program tonight is about the third-party payer system in the United States, and of course it's a hybrid, and it's a fairly miserable hybrid, and I think that both speakers have pointed that out and agree to that basic principle. But let me suggest first that, and I'll put my question in a moment, that moving to a government-managed system, whether it's insurance or the entire healthcare system, is merely another version of third-party payer, because the government then is making the payment decisions, and he who has the gold makes the rules, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And the real question is whether the government's going to do a better job as third-party payer than the current hybrid system.
That's
with
correct.
Some private insurers and also a very, very large government involvement in the healthcare economy. Now, but directly to the point, about 6 weeks ago.
Come to the question.
Sure, let me. In the latest issue of City Journal, Peter Huber, who's a Manhattan Institute scholar, has pointed out that the future of medicine is very clearly, it's becoming apparent that it is targeting specific diseases based upon genetic testing specific to individuals, okay, and that the pharmaceutical industry is following that trend by targeting various kinds of medications to genetic types of diseases and problems, which are very individual in nature. Peter then argues that because that's the direction of modern medicine, the old insurance schemes where one tries to pool very large groups and do medical risk adjustment based upon older diseases, older problems, like tuberculosis, similar kinds of society-wide ills, will not work in the future, that the pooling arrangements in the insurance system are destined to fail, and that therefore going to a 1950s style universal insurance pool as opposed to different kinds of financing arrangements basically are doomed based upon the direction of medicine. Could you respond to that?
Well, I see no reason why it is that if you have a pool, for example, in a province or a state, that requires that you are presenting problems for individualized treatment arrangements. We have individualized treatment arrangements now, even though we have pools. The change in the research that pushes it towards genetics is just another area of innovation in medical care. So, for instance, I wouldn't for a moment imagine that the current administrator of the Ontario Health Insurance Plan would be at all incapable of saying, for these diseases, we need to form arrangements to pay for the interventions that are actually more targeted than the old ones. You know, the connection between the individualized disease problem and the payment arrangement, I just don't see. Now, let me make one additional point to you. In most comparisons of the conduct of medical practice in Canada and the United States over the last 20 years, the striking finding has been that Canadian doctors find themselves less regulated about what they do and more constrained about what they earn by comparison with the Americans who earn more and are constrained more. That is, the decentralized health insurance schemes that tell people whom they can cover and what they can cover and under various schemes the complexity is just not there in the Canadian context. There certainly are supply constraints. That is, it's true that 95% of the hospital beds are actually filled. It's true that Canadians see doctors more per capita than the United States. So there is no question that the real resources are tightly used. But there's no reason in principle to go from this advance in our capacities to a belief that a pooling system can't pay for better research-directed drugs. No reason at all.
Paul Howard is the director of our Center for Medical Progress.
And therefore,
I'm going to ask one.
Therefore, I'm recognizing him to ask a question.
I'm just going to ask
on the basis of.
I'm going to ask one final question of our two eminent speakers this evening, and that is given all of your differences and the points where you obviously disagree, given where we're at today, which is the need for a change in arrangements that gives consumers and patients more peace of mind, more portability, and at the same time helps to reduce some of this excess spending that I think we all see in the system and some of the other problems in the system. Could you see a compromise that would both involve more security, in a sense, for healthcare consumers, and at the sense, more responsibility, more market options, in perhaps the way that Richard might want?
Well,
I think it's very, let me put it to you this way. I'm very pessimistic about all of this. I mean, for example, on the malpractice reforms, I wrote about this in 1976, a bunch of other people have done. I would say, if anything, the pendulum is switched in the wrong direction on that. I think in all the other subsidiary areas, I think it's switched in the wrong direction as well. My fear is that what will happen is all these perfections will be embedded in the system, and that the socialized system or the payment or whatever it is will be put on top of it. And in the end, you're not going to be at 16%. You're going to be at much higher percentage. I do not think, for example, that the American system, given the way in which it reimburses Medicare and so forth, will ever adopt anything remotely like the tough English capitation system or even the Canadian system. So I think what's going to happen is you'll have the same cost-plus reimbursement schemes that we have now, the efforts to use various kinds of devices to control Medicare payments. You'll still have the massive fraud associated with Medicaid. And if we don't know how to administer a system with $2 trillion in it, we're not going to figure out suddenly how to do it right when we get $4 trillion in it. So I just don't see any reason for optimism except for this. I think the technical innovations, if we don't kill them off, will in fact produce benefits for large numbers of people in large numbers of ways. And so I will put it in this simple fashion. If you ask me whether I'd rather have a market system in 1910 medicine or a socialized system in 1990 or 2010 system, I'll take socialized medicine in 2010 to market medicine in 1910. But I think you could do better than that.
Well, that was a concession that really I didn't expect. But I'm glad to see it. I don't want to go back to, you know, 1910 either. It's a good question, and the answer's complicated. I don't know, Richard might actually agree with this. I am so concerned that a kind of halfway house put forward in legislation will produce even more of the worst of all possible worlds. In that we share. We are on a trajectory in which we spend more and feel worse about a lot about that, not all of it. So my position is that I would actually want to restrain what are regarded as compromises among competing plans until we get in place something that's more coherent, defensible, and well-established. So if I had to choose what to do first, what I would do, for instance, is shift the attention to changing the rules called ERISA, which prevents states from experimenting with different plans because of the operation of the 1974 statute. I mean, I don't expect all of you to raise your hands, let's get ERISA, but it actually is a very significant barrier to the very experimentation in the United States about what to do. And so, paradoxically enough, after 40 years of thinking that the social insurance model that attended my first experience in government when Medicare began was likely to be expanded, I'm pessimistic, guarded, worried, concerned, because the danger in this industry is that it'll drive out all the other things we want to do. It gallops along. This third-party scheme of that we've got without restraining forces is just an extraordinarily voracious appetite, and that I think we agree, and maybe I should leave it at that.
On ERISA, just one little point, and then we could stop. ERISA has actually been the one barrier which has prevented states from imposing medical malpractice tort liability on HMOs through the doctrine of ERISA preemption. When you want to change it, you got to be sure which parts you want to change and why. And I mean, you know, I don't know a lot about healthcare, I've been told, but I do know a little bit about ERISA preemption.
Well, I'd like to thank both Ted and Richard for a very illuminating evening. A couple of, I guess, housekeeping notes. For those of you who may be new to Manhattan Institute events, if you'd like to get notice of future debates on important public policy topics that we'll be holding, please leave your business card at the table out front. And I will also note that Richard Epstein, putting on a completely different hat, or a related one anyhow, will next week, what date? 8th of November, will be speaking on the topic, Neither Liberal Nor Conservative, A Maverick's View of the Supreme Court. So please join me in thanking Ted and Richard.
Take care. I'll try to get my education.